Right now, I'm very happy to welcome back to our program Richard D. Wolff, author of the book Capitalism Hits the Fan and his latest, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Richard Wolff is professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, now a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York City. Professor Wolff's recent article about Detroit, Michigan's declaration of bankruptcy is titled Detroit's Decline as a Distinctively Capitalist Failure, published in the Guardian newspaper on July 23rd. Professor Wolff, it's great to have you back here on the program.
Thank you, Scott. I always enjoy going back to PKN that I've been listening to for better half of my life.
makes us feel old, but that's good. We're older and wiser. Professor Wolff, Detroit's declaration of bankruptcy on the 18th of July represents the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. It's certainly symbolic of a lot of problems in the U.S. economy that stretch back decades, not just a few years, not to this latest economic downturn, but long in the making. And I wonder if, as you write about in your article about Detroit, maybe you can speak to what the symbolic nature of this bankruptcy means to you.
Well, you know, I've been around a good while, and I remember, although I was very young at the time, that Detroit in the 1950s and 60s was the great success story of American capitalism. We had, as a nation, become the richest and most powerful after World War II, and nothing symbolized our economic and technical prowess than the stunning automobile industry that was a model for the new transportation systems around the world, something that the German and Japanese car companies took as what they had to do as well or better than if they would have any chance. Detroit exploded as a successful city. It grew enormously in size. 1950, it was just a little shy of 2 million people, making it one of the top 10 cities in the United States. And beyond that, it was so successful, partly because the enormous profits made in the automobile industry persuaded the automobile companies to deal with the workers they had, who over time began to demand decent wages, by basically giving them a steadily rising wage, so that in the 50s and 60s, auto workers in America were among the leaders, the best paid, with the best benefits. They really became the vanguard of what came to be known as the American middle class, hardworking people, but who were able to get jobs that paid well, that were secure, that had really good benefits with them. A whole generation, and not only white people, but African Americans, who were slowly but eventually permitted to take these jobs too. And that suggested to the African American community that they too might participate in the American dream by means of strong unions, getting good jobs in an explodingly profitable industry. So successful was this that Detroit became not only the automobile center, but in the Motown sound, became an influence on world music. The kinds of rock and roll, particularly African-American music again, but nonetheless shaped music in this country and around the world. It was the music that the Beatles listened to. It was the music everywhere that shaped the world. And so it was really a cultural, political, economic powerhouse. And what a long way we have come. Starting in the 1970s, all of that changed. And the automobile industry shrank. The decisions made by the leaders of the automobile companies, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, were terrible miscalculations and mistakes. They failed in the competition with the likes of Honda, Toyota, and all the rest that Americans now drive in record numbers. And when they couldn't figure out how to compete well, they also fell behind in developing fuel-efficient engines, which were the wave of the future. And when those mistakes caught up with them and the profits shrank, then the leaders of those industries made one more big decision, which sealed the doom of Detroit. They basically moved away. They decided if they couldn't become profitable with new technology, with new equipment, with new machinery, with new advances, then they would make money by moving production to where the wages were much, much lower. First in Canada and Mexico, then around the world to places like Brazil, China, and so on. And when they did that, it was the end for Detroit. The jobs dried up. The well-being of the workers atrophied. The union got weaker and smaller and couldn't anymore get the good wages, the good jobs, the good benefits. And the whole downward slide, which has been going on for 35 years. Just to give you a couple of the measurements, just shy of 2 million people in 1950. Today, 700,000 people live in Detroit, which means that our economic system, our capitalist economic system, was unable to sustain good jobs and well-paying jobs and didn't help anybody either. They said to the people of Detroit, we've got nothing for you. Go away. And the majority of Detroit's people had to fend for themselves, leave the city, tear up their relationships with their neighbors, their friends, their relatives, yank their kids out of school, move to another city where, for many of them, the same drama of decline played itself out. You know, if you're going to judge capitalism in America by its successes, like Detroit in the first half of the 20th century, that's fair enough. But then to be consistent and to be honest, you also have to measure and evaluate how well our economic system is when it fails not only to sustain a leading industry. The world is still producing and buying more cars this year than ever before, but they're not American cars. The American industry made bad decisions, the capitalists at the top, and we're all paying the price of that. And a system that cannot sustain good industries, that condemns a city as important as Detroit to the kind of wasteland it now is a system that long ago should have been subjected to real debate, real criticism, and the simple question that an honest people asks of every institution, is this the best we can do, or could the United States be better off without a capitalism that works this way?
Thanks for that excellent summary of the history of Detroit's decline, Professor Wolf. I wondered if you'd comment on Detroit's status as a majority African-American city as being a contributing factor to the abandonment of the city by capital and government of this once great American municipality?
Well, the answer is yes and no. There's no doubt that as the Detroit situation deteriorated, the white workers, the ones that were or felt that they had more mobility, were the ones who left first. That made it more and more of an African-American city. That put it in a different category in the minds of the rest of the state of Michigan, which wasn't African-American preponderantly. It introduced race, of course, into the political mix of decisions. But I would want to stress that this is really mostly an economic story. What is happening in Detroit, while a little worse than in many other places, is not fundamentally different from what is happening to Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, or Youngstown, Ohio, where I was born, or indeed, in many ways, Bridgeport, New Haven, Waterbury, Naugatuck, Seymour. You could go on and on and on in terms of cities that have been abandoned by the capitalists who once made them thriving and prosperous, and for whom nothing could be done. Neither the business community could rescue these cities from decline, nor could the political authorities do it. And in many cases, these were not African American in their prevailing populations, at least for most of the period of time. So I think it's more a decision, and I think it's a national decision that was made back in the 1970s. The corporations that were dominant in America, the General Motors, the General Electric, the Pepsi-Cola, whatever, wherever you look, they all made a basic decision. They were leaving the United States. They had done real well here. They had become big, powerful corporations here. But they felt that their future was where they could get away with paying lower wages. The workers in America, after all, had woken up after 50 years of early capitalism and begun to demand their share. In the depths of the Depression, they joined unions in huge numbers because they saw the union as a way to at least get a piece of the successes of capitalism. And so we had a middle class in America, workers with good and secure jobs. But the very success of the unions and workers in getting a middle class life meant that they had to get paid pretty good wages that became the envy of the world, American wages. But the irony is that the way capitalism works is that the very success of working people in getting good jobs with security and benefit creates an incentive to the employer to run away from such workers, to look around the world and see if there are workers who will do the work for much less money. And with the arrival in the 1970s of rapid jet travel, and then with the arrival of the internet and telecommunications, American capitalists discovered that they could as easily command and control a factory, an office, a store, 1,000 miles away, just as easily as the one down the road. And so capitalists discovered they could make much more money producing in Brazil, or China, or South Africa, or Nigeria. They didn't have to stay in the United States. They could escape the very successful working class whose wages they had been paying. And they've done it. At first they did it with manufacturing jobs, leaving whether it be Singer sewing machines, or General Motors cars, or any of that. But in the last 20 years they've added service industries. You know, if you have a blueprint to produce now, you don't do it. Even if you're building a building here in the United States, you send the blueprints to India, where you can pay draftsmen and architects a fraction of what you pay them here. The work is moved over there, and yet another group of workers in this country discover they don't have a job. They don't have an income. They don't have a pension anymore. And so we're seeing that the capitalism that was good to the United States in its first 150 years or so is the same capitalism that is now saying, bye-bye, we're leaving, and what you are going to become is like the rest of the world you used to see on television that was poor, that didn't have much to go with, that was worried about its future. That's our situation. And it's the urgent clarion call for us to finally face the need to debate and evaluate the economic system we have, because even if you think it served us well in the past, it isn't doing it now, and there's no sign that it's going to be.
We're speaking with Professor Richard D. Wolfe. He's author of Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, and many other books. Professor Wolfe's recent article about Detroit, Michigan's declaration of bankruptcy is titled Detroit's Decline is a Distinctively Capitalist Failure, published in the Guardian newspaper July 23rd. Professor Wolfe, Michigan and Detroit used to be the stronghold of the labor movement, and as the labor movement's declined, so has Detroit and many other cities dependent on declining industries, as you laid out just a moment ago. What lessons can the labor movement learn from the decline of Detroit and the decline of their movement across the country in terms of their lack of influence in making decisions about the future of American industry and retaining jobs here rather than seeing the hemorrhaging of jobs overseas, as you talked about, with the outsourcing to everywhere else in the world. Is there anything different that the union movement could have done in terms of Detroit and in other industrial centers around the country?
Yes, I think so. Let's take a step back. If you have, as you're absolutely right, if you have the picture before you of Michigan, of Detroit, the center of the powerful United Auto Workers, a strong union in its day, a leading union in its day, able to make presidents come and listen to what they had to say, powerful representatives of workers, and you see them today, a pale, small, frightened shadow of itself, then you would have to say that the decline of Detroit and the associated decline of the labor movement would have to make any reasonable person concerned about the labor movement say that whatever the labor movement did over the last 35 years to try to stop this process, to reverse this process, what the labor movement did failed. The failure of capitalism is also the failure of the labor movement to come up with the tactics, the strategy, the ways to save its own people and to save the larger community from this catastrophic decline. I don't put them in the same category as the capitalists because they were the ones in the position to literally decide where the autos get produced, how they're priced, what technology to use. All the really important decisions about that industry were not made by the union. They were made by the owners and the boards of directors. But the union suffered the consequences and would have had to develop tactics and strategy very different from what they used to have avoided the disaster that has befallen them. So a rational labor movement would have had to have horrible, difficult, self-searching conferences and meetings every week and month to analyze what was going wrong and why their traditional strategies weren't changing this disastrous situation. But the truth of it is they didn't do that. They stayed pretty much with the cautious, careful, legalistic strategies that they had always pursued, and those I think history has now pronounced to be a colossal failure. So your question then is, what could they have done? What might they have done? Well, there are at least two things that I would suggest. First, we can take a look at the working classes in Europe who did disagree strategically and tactically with the American unions. For example, the European unions supported, maintained close relationships with socialist and communist political parties. Maybe that's why they have got a national health service that takes care of everybody. Maybe that's why in countries like France and Germany, every worker by law gets 5 weeks of paid vacation every year as soon as he or she enters the labor force. Maybe that's why public education through the university is basically free. In other words, a militant labor movement closely allied with socialist and communist parties in Europe have generated a safety net that makes what we have here in the United States a bad joke by comparison.
But of course, those benefits are under attack right now, which is another chapter in this story. Not to interrupt your flow here, but
and they're under attack, and that attack, as Wisconsin's situation so dramatically shows us, as well as other states, is underway because the unions are too weak to prevail in that situation either. So one thing you could have done is been a lot more militant. Call the general strikes. Build the alliances with community organizations, with or without socialist and communist parties. But they didn't do that here. They broke away from any party other than the Democratic Party, and that has made them the junior partner of that party, and what they have to show for it is not much. But I have a second and a much bigger question. I'm not sure that unions ought to stay with the tried and true and unsuccessful policy of only bargaining with the employer, getting together to decide, if they can, what the wages and conditions are. I think what unions ought to recognize is that as long as the basic economic decisions are made by the major shareholders and the boards of directors they select, the people who decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, then business is going to serve the rich folks who own the shares and their appointed boards of directors. And the union is only going to find out what those strategies are after they're in place, is always going to be reacting, is always going to be coming late to understand what maneuver is being used against them. So for me, what the unions could have and should have and still now should do is develop a second strategy. Sure, you bargain with the employer the way you always did, but here's another way you should be going. You should be saying to the employer, you know, if you don't pay proper wages, if you threaten us that you're going to leave the United States like so many others have, unless we give you one concession after another, here's what we're going to do. You leave. Goodbye. Good riddance. We're going to take over this store, this office, this factory. We, the workers, with our union, we're going to run it. And when you've moved to China and you ship that stuff back and you go to the American people asking them to buy what you're producing, we're going to be right next to you saying to the American people, sure, you could save a few bucks, buy the goods from the company that left the United States, left the cities in a lurch, left the people with no jobs. Or you could buy from us, the workers who kept the plant going, who now produce it as a collective, worker-owned, worker-operated enterprise. Let us compete with those who betrayed the United States by leaving. Give us your business and give Americans the jobs they shouldn't have lost in the first place. I think you would change the whole situation here in the United States. You know, if workers ran their own enterprises, they wouldn't close shop and move to another country because that would be shooting themselves in the foot. And they wouldn't divide the income that they earn so that a few people get hundreds of millions of dollars and everybody else has trouble sending their kid to college. If you want to do something about the inequality of income, then change the way businesses are run. Put the working people in charge of the enterprises. You know, it's a simple idea. If you want an economic system to serve the average people, you've got to put the average people in charge. If you put a tiny minority of rich people in charge of the business of our country, you can't be surprised if the decisions they make make the rich richer. That's who they are. And we cannot keep evading that fundamental issue unless we're prepared to go as far down in the economic scale as we were able before to go up.
Richard, excellent presentation of the body of your work, talked about in your, discussed in your book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. And of course, there are many others around the country putting into practice cooperatives that, you know, have been around for hundreds of years. But there's a new urgency, of course, with the changing of our economy that no longer serves the majority. And it's urgent that people find new models of organizing and production, which is what this book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, is all about. And we've had discussions with you and Professor Gar Alperovitz as well. Some interesting movements afoot in this country. And unfortunately, we're just about out of time, Richard, but I did want to ask you one quick question here about the coming decision that President Obama will be making about who's going to be the country's new new Federal Reserve chair. And, of course, names that have been floated include former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who many blame for deregulation that resulted in our recent economic collapse. And then there's the current Federal Vice Chair, the current Federal Reserve Vice Chair, Janet Yellen. Is there anything you could briefly tell us about this decision coming up and how important it is, or if it's important at all?
Well, it is an important position for sure. the Federal Reserve controls the money supply, has enormous influence over the interest rates, and those are crucial shapers of our economy. But I'm afraid my general take on this is huge disappointment with Mr. Obama. He is continuing most of the policies of his predecessors. He continues to have the same people that literally were in the preceding administration serve in his. Larry Summers and Janet Yellen have been regular, loyal players in the Federal Reserve and in the economic policy making at the highest levels. There's no change coming. You know, for a president who ran on hope and change, we can't have any hope anymore because there's no change. It's the same people. It's like musical chairs. Everybody jumps up and runs around till the music stops. But when the dust clears, it's all the same people, which means we're going to have the same policies since they give us no reason to expect otherwise. And if we have the same policies, we'll keep going in the same direction. And everything I've said this last half hour tells us, I think, as we can all see, that that direction is precisely what needs to be changed.
Richard, as always, it's great to have you here to talk about some of these deeper issues about our economic system, its failures, and hope for the future. Leave our listeners, if you would, with the website for your articles and books and commentary, as well as your radio program.
Right. Very simply, the two websites. The first one is rdwolf2fs.com, where you can see everything that I do. And the other one is democracyatwork.info, and you can listen on WBAI.org, which I believe you get in Bridgeport anyway, every Saturday at noon. The program is called Economic Update. You can also get the archives of those programs on my website, rdwolf.com, and I'm proud to say that radio program is now broadcast regularly in 17 American cities, Tampa, Florida, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and many others. We add one every two or three months, another city. There's a hunger for this kind of analysis, and I think that that's a sign of hope for this country.
And with that, we'll also wish good luck and better times for WBAI in New York, our sister radio station, which is you know, certainly engaged in some hard times here to survive. So if you're making a contribution to this station, don't forget WBAI as well.
Thank you very much, Scott. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Professor Richard D. Wolfe, author of Capitalism Hits the Fan, and his latest work, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism.